Okay, so we are very happy today to have Marco Regis from Università di Torino, who is gonna tell us how to look for axion-like particles in astrophysical objects. Please go ahead.
Okay, many thanks, Christina, for the invitation. And I would like also in the future to visit possibly Perimeter because I've heard from many friends that it is really a special place. And today we'll talk about how to try to detect axion-like particles in astrophysical environment. A more fancy title could have been oxymorons in dark matter searches. In the sense that I will, oxymoron means basically when you try to put together things that looks contradictory with each other, and while oxymoron will be clear, I hope later on. Okay, so let me start with embedding this talk in a certain framework. I think I just heard that most of you are very familiar with axion, so I might skip this slide, but let's still have a very short introduction. And if dark matter has only gravitational interaction with the ordinary matter, then it's going to be very difficult to distinguish the solution to the problems that we see at different scale in the universe associated to gravitational potential that we need to explain several data. In terms either of dark matter or of modified gravity. So if dark matter interacts only through gravitational interaction with ordinary matter, it will be, say, very difficult to distinguish between these two possibilities. So let's hope that nature has been kind with us, so that provided that dark matter with some non-gravitational coupling with the ordinary matter, that would be the working hypothesis. And if dark matter has such non-gravitational coupling, then typically what you have that the interaction that then produce the largest flux of ordinary matter is related to dark matter decay or conversion, except for the cases in which such interaction is prevented by some symmetry. For example, in the case of WIMPs, you cannot have a decay because you have a symmetry preventing this mechanism. For example, air parity for neutralino supersymmetry, K parity for Kautz-Klein in universal dimension, and so on. If you don't have such a symmetry, typically the dark matter decay or conversion is the most interesting coupling. I mean, that produce say more significant signal than other mechanism like annihilations or scattering or others. So we focus on this, and we don't want to be, I don't want to be very specific on the coupling or on the model. So let's say that we have a Feynman diagram like this one, where this blue blob can be whatever. So I'm not, so for example, you can have this chiral anomaly, but you can have something else. And essentially, since you have an interaction with the standard model particle, in the end, you will end up with some emission of photons. And I can consider an effective Lagrangian given by this form. And we will, in the rest of the talk, we will concentrate on putting bounds on this coupling, GA, gamma, gamma. Okay. As you know much better than me, so basically this slide was sort of, it's rather general and not so precise. It was kind of trying to say that I'm going to consider a framework which is which involve very minimal assumption and is rather general. So try to involve a huge amount of model. Of course, there's a bit of hand waving in this slide. Fortunately, due to the online talk, you can just partly see my Italian hand waving. So, okay, so you know better than me that there is many possible realization where to embed such a framework. And let's assume the simplest assumption is that the particle is a scalar or pseudo-scalar particle. And typically, this is realized with a U1 symmetry that is broken. So you have something like distilled Mexican head potential, and you end up with some pseudo-Nambu-Goldson boson. And in the symmetry breaking, the axion acquires a small mass. And you have several nice examples. The main one is the QCD axion. But you have also several other ones, for example, coming from the compactification of extra dimensions in string theory. And for my talk, the main point is that we want that in these scenarios, we have some funny, say, phenomenology associated to the decay of an axion into two photon. Again, here I'm reporting this case, but whatever is the coupling. So the decay of an axion into two photons or a conversion of an axion into photons, essentially is the same coupling, but in this case, the idea is that if you have a magnetic field, an ambient magnetic field, then the axion can be converted into a photon due to this interaction. On top of these general motivations, you can also add some more specific motivation for considering axion-like particles. On the other hand, they are quite debated in the literature, so they are maybe a bit controversial, so I don't want to put too much emphasis on them. Let me just mention that you might explain some possible anomalies in the gamma ray data. Essentially, there's the possibility that we observe too many gamma rays from distant sources than we would expect. And this can be explained by the conversion of a gamma ray photon into an axion in the magnetic field of the source, then is converted back to a photon in the magnetic field of the Milky Way. And in this way, you reduce the absorption of gamma rays. Or there are also claims there are anomalies in the stellar cooling. And again, in this case, the conversion of photons into axion can change the cooling of stars because essentially axion can escape the source and so carry away energy. And more recently, there was the data from xenon one tone reporting electronic recoil excess over the background that can be interpreted in principle, let's say, in terms of solar axion. So I don't want to put emphasis on this additional motivation, but say there's also want to mention that there are also other phenomena that can be relevant in this business. And actually the business is quite big. There are many groups that are working on trying to detect axion-like particles. And in this plot, that is taken from the collection that you can see in this GitHub repository, you have that essentially the colored regions are the regions that are excluded in the parameter space of axion-like particle, where I'm showing here the coupling axion to photon as a function of the mass of the axion-like particle. And the colored region are correspond to different techniques, different methods to constrain axion-like particle, except for this yellow band, which instead is not a bound, but is the preferred, is the region where you have the QCD axion. Okay, so the idea is that if you want to test the QCD axion, you have to reach in this plane, a sensitivity that is at the level of this yellow band. Okay, of course, I don't know details of all of these techniques, so please don't ask me fine details of specific experiments, but say in general, we have the main types of experiments are halloscopes, where you look essentially for the dark matter that is the axion-like particle being dark matter and being present in our rooms by trying to transform this axion into photons due to the coupling with the electromagnetic field. There are different techniques that do that, but the general idea is this one. Then you have the helioscope, where you look for the axion produced by the sun, so the conversion of photon to axion due to the sun. And then there's this other very funny one that is light shining through walls, where you essentially convert photons into an axion, then make this axion going through the wall, and then you convert back to the photon. So if you see this phenomenon, it would be a very funny way to detect axions. We are not focusing on these techniques today. I will talk about instead indirect axion searches, and that are based essentially on decay of axion-like particles in astrophysical structure, and I would say also a few words on conversion of axion to photon in astrophysical structures. And it's not only, it's the fact that it's a big business. You can also see by seeing the prospects that we have for the future. So these other bands with lighter colors are the prospects, say someone for the near future, someone for the very far future, for experiments that will try to constrain the parameter space of axion-like particles. And let's say that the main idea, I guess, is to try to probe the QCD axion region, so to cover this yellow band. Okay. As I said, so this was I'm done with the introduction, and now we talk about some works that we did recently that concern the search for axion-like particles from the decay that these particles have in astrophysical sources. And so we look for a monochromatic emission, because if it is a dark matter particle, it's non-relativistic. We want to have cold dark matter, so the emission of the photons is the energy of the photons is equal to half of the mass of the axion, because you emit two photons. And we want to look for regions where we have high dark matter density, because you have higher probability to decay for the decay, and so you have higher fluxes. Okay, and we did this. This technique, we applied this technique in three different frequency bands. Let's start with the optical and near infrared. So basically it involves the region of this blue column. So essentially a mass of the axion of a few electron volt. And what I'm going to present is based on a paper that is on archive. And another paper that we have in preparation should be on archive before Christmas. Okay. So for several reasons, and one of them, I will mention one of them in a while, we were interested in looking for axion-like particle at the electron volt scale, so with a mass or around electron volt scale. So just to receive this plot, you see that in this case, for the electron volt, you basically the QCD axion is already excluded by other experiments. So you basically try to search for axion-like particles that have a coupling that is somewhat smaller than the coupling that you have for QCD axion. But there are other reasons that make this region of mass is very, very interesting. And so together with Marco Taoso, that is in the audience, is following the seminar, we were thinking about a way to test these axion-like particles. And we said, okay, it's going to be easy. We just have to find an astronomer who is able to use a telescope and point this telescope towards a target which is promising for dark matter searches, like a cluster or a dual spheroidal galaxies or a target like this. And then we try to put some constraints on the coupling of the axion to photons. So we need to have an experiment with a good angular resolution, because we want to be able to identify sources like stars or galaxies that have to be removed or masked, that have a not too small field of view in order to be able to image the source you're interested in. And the other point is we need to have a good frequency resolution, because we are looking for a line. We are searching a line. And so if you have a bin that is too wide, then the line is washed out. And so you are not sensitive to the line. And of course, then you need also to have a good sensitivity in flux. And all these things we want to have for an experiment looking observing the darkness. I mean, observing regions where you do not have stars or bright galaxies, and so on. So something regions where you do not have astrophysical backgrounds, and you want to search for the dark matter signal. So we realized that it is not so easy to have such an experiment, essentially because you have two different approaches in astronomy, in optical and infrared astronomy. And one is called photometry, where basically you want to have very nice images of the sky, very good angular resolution, but where you do not have a very good frequency resolution. So essentially you have quite wide bins in frequency or in energy wavelength. So you don't have a good frequency resolution. On the other hand, you have spectroscopy, so spectroscopic observations, where on the other hand, you focus on the interesting targets that were possibly highlighted from photometric observation. And on this object, you go and you try to look for the spectrum. And so you do spectroscopy, but you do essentially in points in the sky, not in a wide region. And essentially in poor words, the problem is that you have a cube, which is given by the two spatial dimension, and the third dimension is the frequency dimension. And if this cube becomes too big, then you have technical difficulties of different kinds. And so it's difficult to build an experiment able to do, to have this approach. But luckily, we found one that is so after a bit of search, which is the MUSE experiment. MUSE stands for Multi-Unit Spectroscopic Explorer, which is an experiment who has a good, not excellent, but good frequency resolution. So essentially you have a frequency resolution of order of per mil. So you can have a bin of a size of per mil, and covering the wavelength between, say, 0.5 and 1 micrometer. And so we contacted the guy of MUSE experiment, and they actually are observing dwarf spheroidal galaxies. One of the goals of this experiment is to observe dwarf spheroidal galaxies, and dwarf spheroidal galaxies are one of the best targets where to look for dark matter signals. Why? Because they are the closest galaxies that we know, except of course for the Milky Way, and they are highly dominated. I mean, the mass component is dominated by dark matter. They have a high mass to light ratio, what they call mass to light ratio, of the order of the 10 to the 2 or 10 to the 3, which means that they are dominated in the mass budget by dark matter. In general, the field of dwarf spheroidal galaxies is a very hot field, because most of these objects were discovered very recently. So the vast majority of dwarf spheroidal galaxies that we know were discovered, 20 years ago by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And others were just recently discovered in the past couple of years by the Dark Energy Survey. And many more are likely to come in the near future surveys. And they are used as one of the best targets for dark matter searches, for what I just said. And for this work, for the work I'm going to discuss here, we focused on one dwarf spheroidal, that is the Leo T dwarf spheroidal. Then in a follow-up, we are planning to study also, to put together all the dwarf spheroidal galaxies that have been observed by the MUSE collaboration. We focus on Leo T because it's an interesting target, and also because data were available. And there is a significant dark matter component in LeoT that is testified by the dispersion velocities of stars. That is what is plotted in here. So here basically is the velocity dispersion as a function of the distance from the center. And this is of the order of 5 to 10 kilometers per second, which means that the gravitational potential is significant. And so that the dark matter density is pretty large. Okay. We use the observation covering one arc minute square, so region like the one in this image on the left. And actually the image that, the image shown here is what they call the white light image, essentially adding up the flux of all frequency channels. So essentially integrating over frequency. And this black blob with some green contours are the regions where we have sources like stars or similar things that are masked. And the rest should be just essentially noise. And you can see this also from the plot here on the right, where instead of integrating over frequency, I do the opposite. So I essentially take the average flux in a given wavelength beam, in a given frequency beam, and I show the this average flux as a function of wavelength. So I'm basically averaging over the spatial coordinates.
Yeah, may I ask you, so you say like in between there should be just noise, but yeah, but what about, I mean, we have a lot of stuff between this dwarf galaxy and us, like dust, gas, that knows what. So I mean,
These stars are mostly, they are not, some of them are not belonging to the dwarf, are either background or foreground sources.
Yeah, yeah, stars, yes. No, but I'm talking also about dust. So something like distributed.
Yeah.
Dust and gas.
Sure. This is a very good point. I was about to mention this. And this is the reason why we have such a huge, the spikes in this plot. So because essentially some of the channel are contaminated by molecular lines of the atmosphere or other media as you were suggesting. So there is a model. They are people doing observation in this frequency range are used to these contaminants. So they have a model to remove, to correct for that. But still you have some remnants of this contamination. The good point is that they are, if they come from atmosphere, they are flat in space. So you see something which is uniform. You should see something very uniform as a function of the spatial distance from the center. While if they come from an object like stars or so on, they are very localized in some specific region. So we do not expect something which has the shape of the dark matter profile essentially. Okay, because here if you have a dark matter signal, you have something which is varying according to profile, which is the dark matter profile.
I see. So this profile is included in the data analysis, basically.
Yeah, exactly. We do an analysis where we include, where essentially we take a single wavelength beam, where we have the template for foreground subtraction, and then to this we add also a constant term to account for possible lines from the atmosphere that are not properly modeled by this template. And then we have a model for you have the spatial distribution of dark matter, and you analyze, you do a morphological analysis of the signal, say frequency beam, in each frequency beam. Okay. Mm-hmm. This plot on the right, it's just not showing the morphological analysis, but it's just to show one thing, is that if you combine, if you average this flux and you take, for example, let's consider this red, the red line is the flux that you expect from an axon-like particle of 5 electron volt and a coupling of 10 to the minus 12. that if we go back to this plot, 10 to the minus 12 is here. So it's way below, say, other bounds. And still, even if you don't do a morphological analysis, you can immediately see that we can constrain this model with this data. Okay, the morphological analysis, of course, is useful when you have contamination because it allows you to distinguish, the dark matter from the contaminants. And so doing this analysis, we end up in obtaining the constraints that I'm showing here. And as you can see, basically these are the bounds that are coming from stellar cooling, and we can improve them by a significant amount, one or two orders of magnitude. And you can see it's not regular, these bounds, exactly because we have some contamination in the frequency, in some frequency channels. And okay, so the region above this curve is the one that is excluded. And you have this violet band that accounts for the uncertainty on the dark matter profile. Essentially, we know in a relatively good way the profile of this target. We have data from dispersion velocity of stars and data from the gas dynamics that allows us to model the dark matter profile at the scales that are relevant for this study. And also MUSE, one of the goals of MUSE is to map, say, the dark matter profile. That there's nothing published yet, but from preliminary data, we check that is our model is also consistent with their data. So if we account for this uncertainty, we have this band that is limited also because not only because the profile is not so uncertain, but also because the coupling depends on the square root of the so-called D factor, basically on the square root of the density of dark matter. So it's not a big dependence. Let me also mention that there was a previous work that was doing similar analysis using a telescope. What essentially the telescope, the very large telescope that was adopted before MUSE. This analysis is of 15 years ago, so of course the sensitivity was lower, and also the target that they observed was a cluster, a distant cluster. So it's somehow the flux was a little bit lower. And so with this analysis, we were able to improve bounds. We have this white window here because this region was used for calibration. And so we cannot use them for the observation. The observation cannot be done in these bands.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
It seems to be pretty flat in the axion mass. Although the decay width of the axion sugar is the cube of the mass, it's true that there is also another mass in the density, but do they cancel out eventually? Like, is it flat in mass, or I should see some trends?
Also is related to the observation, that how they scales with the sensitivity, how scales with the frequency. Okay, so it's right what you say with the coupling, but we have to combine this with the scaling of the sensitivity of the experiment with the frequency. So essentially, in the end, all these factors roughly cancel out.
Okay.
And as I was saying before, there are reasons to there are general reasons to try to search for an axion-like particle in all the mass range possible, but a specific reason for this mass range was provided by the fact that there is an excess in the measured angular power spectrum of the near-infrared background. What is the near-infrared background anisotropy? So essentially, if you look at the anisotropy of this background, it's essentially as doing the same thing that, as you do for the CMB, just at the near-infrared frequencies. And you try to, what you do, you basically measure your anisotropies, the power spectrum of your anisotropies as a function of the multiple. So the CL as a function of L is the same plot that you have seen many times for the CMB, in this case, just for the instead of microwave for near infrared. And in this case, it seems well established that there is an excess of power at multiples around 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4. There are several papers discussing this this excess, and there is a wide consensus in the community that this excess is somewhat puzzling. For example, here I'm reporting the plot that I'm reporting is from a science paper, and in this wavelength range. There are different explanations that have been proposed in the past years. One is the so-called intrahalo light, which is essentially light from stars that are not in galaxies. Because what you do here, essentially, you try to fit this data with what you know, with all the galaxies and stars that you know that are emitting in the near infrared. And what you get is that this is not enough. So you need something else. This something else might be stars that are not in galaxies. So because of merger events, they can be stripped away from the galaxy, so they can be isolated. And of course, they still emit light, so you should add some light from stars that are not in galaxies. Of course, naively, you would expect that you don't have most of stars outside galaxies, so you would expect that this emission is low. But it's possible that it is not so low, and this would account for the excess, even though this explanation has been also criticized exactly because you need to have a lot of stars that are not in galaxies. Another explanation that has been proposed is in terms of early time black holes. First, in terms of black holes that are produced at high redshift, and recently also since primordial black holes became quite an hot topic, there was the attempt to embed this explanation in terms of primordial black holes. And this can work, but of course it's at the price of introducing an exotic component. So for exotics, let's introduce an axon-like particle decay and an axon-like particle a few electron volt mass. And if the axion decay in and has a mass of a few electron volt, then in this paper in 2016, they showed that it can actually fit this excess, and so it can explain the data, which is the coupling for fitting this excess. It's in the mass, so it's reporting this plot. So here the mass is around 4-5 electron volt, and the coupling is expressed in terms of this parameter. Perhaps it's better to see this more familiar plot where you have these two stars that basically are the fit to the data for two slightly different models. So they correspond to this blue region. And so the coupling is around 10 to the minus 11. So if we go back to our data, so 10 to the minus 11 is here. So essentially, we excluded this explanation unless, of course, it's in the white window. But having said that, we
just coming back to this explanation. So the idea was what? Just to say that dark matter halos are made of axions, and that would give the natural anisotropies.
Exactly. Yes. You have all the halos that you have in the universe would emit some light. So since you have a halo, a different redshift, this means that you emit a different wavelength just because from the wavelength of emission, then the emission is redshifted. So what reaches us is redshifted. So you have a sort of continuum emission from the extragalactic halos, and adding up all the halos that we have in the universe, you have this emission that have an anisotropy that is due to the fact that you have a clustering, so matter is clustered in halos.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And but yeah, the coupling that you need seems to be a bit high, at least compared with our finding with MUSE. And so we try to reconsider this idea. This is the analysis that we have in progress by adding some data sets, also longer wavelength data, And introducing also a term due to the intrahalo light, so that maybe the coupling needed can be a little bit smaller. And also we included other terms that were not included in the previous analysis that actually should be included to have a full computation, and that might in principle enhance a little bit the dark matter signal. And so we essentially revisited this possibility. And what we are finding in is summarized in this plot, where you have again coupling as a function of mass, and here you have these two regions. One case is without introducing the intrahalo light, the green one, and the blue line is introducing the intrahalo light. We found as well the best fit. This region, but as a local minimum in our analysis, so it's not say the global minimum. By doing all these changes that we have done, but the bad news is that the coupling that you actually need after all this revisiting is a little bit higher, so it's the order 10 to the minus 10, so it's going, and because also the mass becomes a little bit smaller, and so essentially is in tension even with the stellar cooling bounds. So it seems that this explanation of the near infrared background is not easy to be accommodated by emission by axon-like particles. Let me now move to a different band. So,
just question. So,
sure.
Does it apply also to other decaying dark matter? I believe it's not necessarily axons, right? Anything decaying into photons or yeah, or anything emitting a line, right? Anything decaying.
Exactly. I'm just taking, say, very general way. You have a coupling, so into two photons. I was showing something like this. You have a certain coupling into two photons.
Yeah,
and that's it.
No, but I'm thinking even
you can put
one photon is okay. Yeah, if you have
mm-hmm. You can rephrase, of course, the bounds in terms of the lifetime. And so you don't assume any coupling, and I mean you just put mm-hmm. the bounds in the lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, which means that this explanation for infrared near infrared background won't work for any decaying dark matter. It seems so.
Yeah.
So yeah, in other words, explaining this near infrared in terms of decaying dark matter doesn't work apparently, according to your finding.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, it seems to be intention. Then, of course, there are people saying that this bound from, if you go to low mass, then you can avoid our bounds because we arrive up to 2.7 or so electron volt. Then if you say that these stellar cooling bounds have some uncertainties that are not, I mean, maybe you can play a bit, but I would say that is disfavored.
Okay, yeah, intention disfavored, yeah, like always in astrophysics.
Yeah.
You cannot rule out.
Yeah.
So, okay. Sorry, can I ask something? The mass range that you're excluding depends on the frequency of the experiment you're using, right? But you mentioned that you are gonna do other analysis. Do you think you can expand that or?
Well, it would be good, but we couldn't find any experiments at the moment that is able to do the job that MUSE is doing, because we would like to have smaller masses, of course. Would have been more interesting to have like electron volt masses, but unfortunately it doesn't seem that there is an experiment available at the moment with the sensitivity of MUSE to do this job.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Because of course the mass that you probe is basically the twice the frequency of the experiment. Okay, let's now focus on a different band, which is the radio band. And here, I mean, there is a quite a big motivation to focus on this region that is related to QCD axion, because if you consider that the main mechanism for producing QCD axion in the early universe, I mean, the misaligned mechanism, you typically have a mass of the axion which is of the order of tens of micro electron volt. So you are in this plot, you are here, not 10 to the minus 5. So you are in the radio regime. And so it's relevant to probe this range. And indeed, you have several experiments that are trying to probe this this mass range. What we investigated is the decay. It's the same as before. So the decay of an axion-like particle in an astrophysical source, like, for example, dwarf spheroidal galaxies. But in this case, there is a difference. The difference is related to the fact that the stimulated decay is very relevant at these frequencies. So what is a stimulated decay? Probably you know very well, but let's just summarize. Let's consider, for example, an atom with two different energy levels. If a photon is coming and the atom is in the ground state, then can go up to the excited state. And if it is in the excited state, can go down and emit a photon. This is the spontaneous emission. But there's a third mechanism. So the first was absorption. The second is spontaneous emission. There's a third mechanism. So if you have the atom in the excited state and the photon is coming, then it can go down to the ground state and emit two photons. At first sight, this might be a bit counterintuitive, but it is an effect due to quantum mechanics that is verified in several systems like lasers. Okay, and in our case, we want to consider this possibility for the axion. So essentially, we want to have a stimulated emission due to the fact that you have some ambient photon that can stimulate the decay of the axion-like particle. And this is a very relevant effect, as you can see from this plot, where I'm plotting the ratio between stimulated emission and spontaneous emission. So the emission associated to stimulated decay or the one associated to spontaneous decay. And if you have in any place of the universe, you have an ambient photon field, which is given by the CMB or by other sources at lower frequency. So in the microwave region, you have the main ambient photons are the CMB photons. And in this case, these photons induce a stimulated emission that is represented by the solid black line in this plot. So the CMB photon can actually enhance the decay by a factor even of three orders or four orders of magnitude, depending on the frequency and on the mass of the axion with respect to the spontaneous decay. If you go to lower frequencies, then you have that the background is not only, it is not dominated by CMB photon, by the photons due to radio sources. So this is this green line. So in any point in the universe, you would experience such a stimulated effect that is given by the black and the green line, which is quite big at these frequencies. Why I didn't consider this effect in the previous analysis, because this effect scales as the energy to the cube, as the inverse of the energies to the cube. So if you go to the optical or to the infrared, it's subdominant, so it's negligible. As you can see, before we were constraining electron volt masses, so we will be on the right in this plot. So this effect is negligible. But at the radio frequencies, this is extremely relevant. The red lines here are the case of the galactic center. So if you look for emission at the galactic center, so there you have even more photons. I mean, it's very bright at the galactic center. So you have even a more pronounced stimulated emission. And depending on how small is the region you consider, you go to a region which is brighter and brighter. So that there's more and more photons on average. So you have a higher and higher effect. Okay.
So I can ask you, so in this case of axion decay, the stimulated emission will correspond to the absorption of one photon and the decay with a final emission of three photons?
Okay, thanks for the question, because I can then talk about this annoying slide, otherwise would have been probably too boring. So essentially here, can you hear me? Sorry, I had a message. Okay, so essentially we did the derivation of the effect. Even if it's a relatively simple exercise of quantum mechanics, we couldn't find it on a textbook or other papers, even though later we realized that there is a work that is not on archive, but over a few years ago, that is discussing, it's a different derivation, but say discussing similar things. Anyway, so you have an initial state where you have axion and photons, and then you have a final state where you don't, you have one less axion, so you have a decay, and then you have two photons. And in order to generate, to go from this initial state to the final state, you need an Hamiltonian, which has a, say, lowering operator for the axion. You need to destroy one axion and two rising operator for the photons. Then if you compute the matrix element for the axion decay, you get something. Then you can consider also the opposite process, that is the two photons producing an axion, because of course you have also this opposite process. And what you want to consider is the difference between the square of these two matrix elements. And doing this computation, what you get is the following. You get three terms. One, which is proportional to the occupation number of axions, so to the density of axions, and this is the spontaneous decay. Of course, the spontaneous decay depends on how many axions you have in your region. Then you have a term which is actually an absorption term that is proportional to the square of the density of the photons, because essentially it's called absorption, which means that you create an axion from two photons. So since you need two photons, it's proportional to the square of the density of photons. And it has opposite sign, because of course this increases the number of axions instead of decreasing. And then you have a third term, which is proportional to the product of the density of axion and density of photons, that is the stimulated decay case, and it is proportional to the density of axion, because you need the axion to decay, and also photons, because you need photons to stimulate the decay. The condition that you have to have the stimulated decay to be the dominant mechanism is that the axion occupation number is larger, much larger than the photon occupation number. Otherwise, of course, the absorption term would win with respect to the stimulated decay. And so you will have production instead of decaying of axion. But the fact is that here we are considering low mass axions. And so since the energy density is fixed because we want them to be dark matter, you have the number density of axion is very large because the mass is low. And so you typically this condition is verified. And so you have that you can neglect this absorption term, and you when you then integrate over space density, you get a factor which is one or plus two times the occupation of photons, which is the terms that I was showing the previous plot, the terms that I'm showing here. Okay, so you modify the decay rate by this amount, which can be several orders of magnitude at low radio frequency.
Yeah, so because of this property that FA is very large, well, axion field is actually classical. So I wonder if you make the classical treatment, yeah, the classical treatment takes into account all this Bose enhancement and things like that. I wonder if you take the classical treatment of the field, both axions and photons, do you get the same answer or different? Did you try that? Okay, that's what I'm asking. Did you try to make just classical analysis of like axion field oscillating and some electromagnetic waves, you know, going around, and how the electromagnetic field will evolve? That's probably an alternative derivation of what you did.
Yeah. No, we didn't consider this. Sorry, maybe I lost the first part of your question because I had a low volume. So, but if I understood correctly, no, we didn't consider the possibility. But it sounds interesting. Maybe we can discuss.
Right. Yeah, because I wonder if there can be further enhancements due to this collective, just classical, like classicality of axion field, which you don't take into account here.
Yeah, no, we don't.
It's the trace value.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And okay, so then since this might be so usually one people consider mainly the conversion of axon into photon, not the decay, but because the stimulated say mechanism was not considered, let's say. So actually it can be very relevant, as we as I just mentioned, and so it's possible that a near future experiment in radio astronomy can be able to test this hypothesis. And in particular, the radio astronomy has entered the golden era because of essentially of the square kilometer array. So it's, which is a collection of antennas of array of yeah, of antenna that that will make the most powerful radio telescope. And these antennas are in Africa and in Australia. And just to have an idea on how the field will progress, now we know about a few millions of radio sources. We expect with the SKA to detect a few billions of sources. So we expect a big improvement in this field. So we considered a few experimental setup that should be realized in the near future. I don't want to bother you with the details. The main point is that if you're interested, of course, we can discuss. Then we considering these four different experimental setups, we derived bounds associated to the stimulated decay of an axion in different astrophysical, in different targets. Again, the same plot of coupling as a function of mass. And here, this pink orange region is the one that is already excluded. And also the blue one, this is from Halloscope and Helioscope, sorry. And then these dotted, these dashed lines are instead forecast for an helioscope and shining through all experiment of the future. And what we got are instead the colored bands for the different experimental setup and for different targets. Here is for dual spheroidal galaxies, so it's exactly the same as I discussed before for in the case of the optical. But now just we consider different targets, but same idea, just we have the stimulated decay. Then another problem is in target is the galactic center, because we expect the dark matter density to be very high there. But what is my opinion on, very interesting is a different target. It's M87, which is an elliptical galaxy of the Virgo cluster. But apart from the details, it's a source which is extremely bright in the radio. And since it is extremely bright, this enhances gives a very large stimulated decay. So the idea here is that you have a very bright continuum source that stimulates the decay of the axion-like particle. So you want to see a faint line over a very bright continuum. And actually, we know in general in physics how to do that, how to see a faint line over bright continuum background. And this is the main idea of the stimulated decay, if you want. Okay.
Sorry, simple question, which I'm a bit confused about. So actually, yeah, this is the first time I think about this stimulated decay thingy. So what happens with the cosmology of the axion in this case? Very early on, you're saying that CMB photons, for instance, can lead to a large decay rate. So early in radiation domination, then I will expect an even larger decay rate. What happens with the cosmology of the axion dark matter then?
Yeah, we wanted to try to apply this to early universe. We haven't done yet. We haven't considered it in details. I'm just trying to recall because we discussed we also with my other collaborators this possibility, and first sight was not so promising. I mean, the effect should be relatively small, but
can I say, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but yes, the effect will be small, because the point is in the early universe, you have the plasmon mass that blocks. In principle, you could have an instability and you could have resonant conversion, exponentially fast conversion of axions to photons. but you have the plasmon mass in the early universe. So the plasmon mass blocks this effect, even if the coupling is very large in principle. So, frequency matching, right? So right. Maybe at the CMB times, maybe you there yeah. you get more because the plasmon effect is down, but there is reionization. So that part needs to be worked out. I would imagine that's also small because the amplitude of the axion is small. So
yeah. But if the plasma effect, I guess before CMB, the plasma effect is very large.
Yeah, so it's like
for, right, for present times, I guess that's not an issue for the bounds that they are setting now. Even though in some environments it may be an issue, I don't know.
I mean, the occupation number of photons during, I mean, the CMB temperature is 1 eV, right? Here we're talking about 10 minus 6. So the occupation numbers drops like omega cubed, I think, at smaller frequencies compared to the temperature. So that would drop the occupation number as well. Higher densities early on, you have 10 to the, at the time of the CMB, I don't know, 10 to the 9 more dense environment. You're also 10 to the 6. So I think overall, I mean, if the effect is, you may find that the galactic effect still dominates if you take all those things into account.
Anyway, there are many, I think there are many possible interesting applications associated to this effect that has to be worked out in general. So just if I can use other 5 minutes.
Sure.
We started a bit late, so no worry.
Okay, thanks. So essentially the good, as I said, it's in this case, you have a bright source. So that's a sort of oxymoron, no? We want to search for a dark matter signal from the brightest sources that we have in the baryonic component that we have in the universe. And the uncertainty here, as you can see, is very small, essentially, because it's very far away. So you basically probe just the mass, not the internal profile of dark matter. So the mass is very well constrained. So I think these kind of targets can be new and very interesting targets for searching for this effect. And related to this idea and to the fact that, as I said, you might have many funny applications, I want to mention other two papers that are not from our group, but that uses this proposed stimulated emission. And one is quite funny, which is send a powerful beam, out in space, and because we have if the axion like particle are the dark matter component, we have them around us, so you will have some stimulated decay of axion in this column, say where the beam goes, and they can be emitted in the opposite direction with respect to the beam, and so they can come back to us. So the idea is to send a powerful beam and listen for its echo. It's quite funny, but And actually, in this PRL paper, they showed that you can reach some in principle level, which is of the order of 10 to the minus 11. So more or less here. So can be interesting, even though they didn't discuss, was not discussed yet, some technical details, because of course the atmosphere is not totally transparent, so you will have backscattering from the atmosphere, so you have to work out if whether then the foreground, the background is huge, is where you can really see such a signal, but at least in principle it's a funny and nice idea. And similar idea is what they call the Gegenschein, axion Gegenschein. So if there's some German in the audience, and I'm not pronouncing in the right way the effect. So basically the idea is the same. So instead of using a powerful beam, you use an artificial beam, you use a source that you have in the sky that provides essentially the beam. So if the light is coming to the Earth and passing just close to the Earth, then after the Earth, then they can induce some stimulated decay in this region, this green region, say after the position of the Earth, and so some of the photon will be emitted in the opposite direction, so towards us. And so you should be able to see a counter source. So if you have a bright radio source in the sky, then you might have a fainter source in the opposite direction because of the stimulated decay of the axion. This was a recent idea proposed in this paper. And they considered an experimental scenario that is a bit more optimistic than what we considered, but reached some possible sensitivity that is again close to 10 to minus 11 or something like this. And I just mentioned these two papers because they are a nice application of the stimulated decay effect, but there are many other ideas in the field, which is quite a sparkling field at the moment. And for example, there is this idea to see again the stimulated axion-like decay in around spinning black holes, because if the black hole is spinning, then can convert some rotational energy into clouds.
Yeah, that won't work, I can tell you. Like,
yeah,
they
okay.
Get the plasmon mass completely. I mean, this is just a bad paper, sorry.
Okay, but there was this, so also this, I was this recent.
Yeah, one. I know that they forget the fact that there is Bondi accretion, there is the plasmon mass that would block stuff around the black holes.
Okay.
So unless you have primordial black holes, so we're talking about several Nobel prizes after you discover the axion, then you may have some effect. But for astrophysical black holes, whose the relevant mass scale is 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 11 eV, I mean, you have stuff around black holes. The plasmon mass will block this.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for... and so we are... so that. Our methods is even more relevant. And also I wanted to just to compare the last thing that I want to say is that comparing to the more traditional way to try to see to do indirect searches of axion in the radio band, that is the conversion of axion in into a photons due to the presence of a magnetic field. Okay, these recent PRL papers, there are a number of PRL papers in this subject that have been published recently. And in this paper, they consider the neutron stars. So neutron stars have a strong magnetic field. So if you have a dark matter around neutron stars, then this magnetic field can convert an axion into photons. So we can see an emission due to the axion conversion. And the main point, I mean, and this method is very promising. On the other hand, is much more uncertain than the stimulated decay, because you need to know the dark matter density in a very small region around neutron stars, while we are considering, say, larger regions, so you can average a lot of small scale effects. And also you need to know very well the magnetic field of neutron stars, which is not so well known. So it's more uncertain, but in principle also very, very promising. So I guess these two methods can be complementary. So as you can see also here, you have that what they found is a bound here, this mass for the electrons. So it's again on the same coupling, and this green band is the uncertainty associated to the bound. Okay, to conclude, I think it's a period where there's no strong bias concerning the particle dark matter mass. While, I don't know, 10 years ago, everybody was looking for, say, GeV, TeV dark matter for WIMPs. Now, really, I think the WIMPs are still alive and an attractive scenario, but also there's significant motivation. There are significant motivation to look for other masses ranges. So one is to take a multi-wavelength approach. So to investigate several different wavelengths for doing indirect searches of dark matter. And let's be open to the possibility of a funny nature. So to be open to oxymorons like dark matter shining in the visible, or looking for, finding an axion signal, a dark matter signal in the direction of bright sources in the sky. Thank you very much for the attention and also for interacting during the talk.
Thank you very much, Marco. Yeah, we can give you a virtual round of applause. Thanks. Are there any more questions?
Yeah, so I have a simple question, I guess, that you partially, well, you try to explain, I guess, but it's not totally obvious to me. So the data set that you guys are using, it has the characteristics that you laid out in the beginning of your section, of your talk. Now, one obvious place that I will have naively looked at, which has excellent spectroscopic data at precisely the similar frequencies, is just Lyman alpha kind of probes. The Lyman alpha transition is 10 electron volts, but the probes are looking at stuff that is redshifted, like redshift of field 3, 4, 5. So then that's redshifted down to a energy of a few electron volts. I don't know, 1 to 5 electron volts or something like that. And there's lots of spectroscopic data about that, right? From mics, this high res, XQ100, all sorts of things looking for Lyman alpha data. Is it obvious that these kind of data sets are not useful?
Okay, so which kind of emission you would like to see? An emission from
so just look at
which from a source.
You just look at the void, whatever, and you just look at the line of in the line of sight their axions. Like, I mean, Lyman alpha stuff is looking at gas, yeah, that is very far away.
Yeah, so exactly.
We don't care about that. But before getting to that, there's, I guess, a column of dark matter, both here in this galaxy and in other galaxies far away.
Yeah, I mean, the main point, at least maybe there's some possibility to do work, but I think the main point is that they look to direction, so precise directions, not on the diffuse, say, regions. So basically, it's this is the problem of spectroscopy, no? That we want to be not to avoid the brightest spots, and we want to have something where we can do morphological analysis. So we want to have to map a region where you do not have. At least in part of the region, you do not have a bright emission. Okay, if you do a good spectroscopy of some points in the sky, then maybe you can think about you can try to constrain, but also helps in this way. But naively, I would expect that it's not so good as doing an analysis where you instead can do a morphological analysis.
I mean, maybe it just gives you better constraints on a slightly different range of frequencies.
Close. Right, that you can, of course, will be less powerful, but covering different frequency bands.
Yeah, which is right this close.
I agree. One has to see how powerful it is, because of course you want to be at least comparable to existing bounds. But in principle, you can do that.
And there, the angular resolution is worse, but maybe you don't care too much about losing there for like Lyman alpha service, no?
Right. I mean, from what he was showing, actually, so it's true that you're using these morphological information, but in one of the plots that you showed, your peak was so high at one particular axon mass so much higher than the background that you didn't even need to do a morphological analysis to set a bound. Yeah, right. That one, right?
Yeah. In this case, yeah.
So in that case, you don't really need an excellent angular resolution, I guess.
Yeah. So it would be great if you can cover, of course, this part here.
Well, right. Like, you know, just to follow up on this question, there's going to be many, many line intensity mapping surveys, right? You know, so besides Lyman alpha, there's, carbon monoxide line intensity mapping, you know, C plus 21 centimeter, right? You know, so these are covering like vast ranges of frequency, and they're mapping like large areas of the sky, right? You know, and so in principle, you can, I mean, I would think you would be able to, you know, to like, you know, like, you know, well, to place strong bounds across a range of frequencies just by cross-correlating what you see in those intensity maps with like galaxy maps at various redshifts, right?
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for the comment, because I had actually a backup slide on this. And because this was analyzed in a paper by Craig Sabinowski, sorry, and Kamenkowski, a couple of years ago. Actually, if you take their what they derived, of course, the idea is very interesting, but it's somewhat, I mean, it's not so strongly constrained. So basically here the idea, probably you know already quite well, is that since you have a axon like decaying at a certain frequency, then and you have a certain redshift, then what you observe is that energy redshifted by 1 plus Z. And you can cross-correlate, so essentially a given frequency corresponds to a given redshift for the axion emission. And so you can cross-correlate the galaxy, the large-scale distribution probed by galaxies with the at that redshift with this emission, and you should find a correlation just with that redshift and not with the other redshift, because in this case, the alpha emission is coming at this specific frequency, is coming from a specific redshift. And this is what is called, it's called line intensity mapping. And we studied this in a different context, in the context of sterile neutrino. So for X-ray line intensity mapping. So this is what we obtained. But this was done also for axon-like particles in the radio and say infrared and optical bands in this paper. And I mean, bounds are interesting, but somewhat seems to be lower than what you get from individual targets. Then I don't know. I mean, I haven't done it. I haven't done the computation, and so I don't know the details. But at least first sight, individual targets for some reason seems to be a bit more promising.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Great. So I don't see any more questions. So I guess we can thank Marco again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the interaction. It was very stimulating.